Good morning, and welcome to Galecto's Expert Perspectives call on the myelofibrosis treatment landscape, current and potential future treatments. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. A question-and-answer session will follow the formal presentations. If you would like to submit a question, you may do so by using the Q&A text box at the bottom of the webcast player or by emailing your questions to questions@lifesciadvisors.com. As a reminder, this webinar is being recorded, and a replay will be made available on the Galecto website following the conclusion of the event. I would now like to turn the call over to your host, Hans Schonbein, Chief Executive Officer of Galecto. Please go ahead, Hans.
Thank you, Tara. Good morning, good afternoon, everybody, and sorry about the brief delay in getting started here this morning. My name is Hans Schonbein. I'm the CEO of Galecto. I'd like to welcome you to this Expert Perspectives panel on the current treatment landscape and unmet clinical need in the fibrosis-related blood cancer called myelofibrosis. We'll also be examining the potential of GB2064, Galecto's LOXL2 inhibitor that will be entering a phase II trial this quarter. Before we start, if you could go to the next slide, I'd like to draw your attention to this forward-looking statement. Next slide, please. I'll start today with a few words about Galecto. We are a clinical-stage biotech company focused on fibrosis and cancer. Our lead assets have orphan drug protection, and we are developing small molecule therapeutics that target two proteins, galectin-3 and LOXL2, or lysyl oxidase-like-2, both of which are proteins that have been shown to be centrally involved in the development of fibrosis and cancer. We are just about to initiate a trial, a phase IIa trial with GB2064, which is an oral LOXL2 inhibitor in myelofibrosis. This will be an important milestone for Galecto and is the focus on this call today. Myelofibrosis represents a very significant unmet medical need. Currently approved treatments are limited by side effects and their loss of efficacy over time. We believe that GB2064 has the potential to be disease-modifying. LOXL2 is upregulated in the fibrotic tissue in myelofibrosis patients in the bone marrow, and LOXL2 has been shown to play a central role in fibrosis and disease progression in the tumor microenvironment. So our expectation is that inhibiting LOXL2 may help restore bone marrow function. Now, please allow me to introduce our key opinion leader today, Dr. Serge Verstovsek, who is a professor of medicine and a hematologist-oncologist at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. At MD Anderson, he is a professor in the Department of Leukemia. He's a director of clinical research in the Center for Myeloproliferative Neoplasms, or MPN, and he's a chief of the section for MPN. He's also a founder and director of the largest MPN clinical research center worldwide. Dr. V, as he would like us to call him, has achieved international acclaim for his leadership in developing landmark MPN therapeutics. He's led more than 60 clinical trials of novel MPN drugs, including the JAK1/2 inhibitor ruxolitinib, the first FDA-approved drug for myelofibrosis. Currently, he's leading several pivotal phase III trials for promising myelofibrosis medication. Serge will discuss the current treatment landscape and the unmet medical need in treating patients with myelofibrosis. We'll also address the opportunity for GB2064 as a potential treatment option, and then I'll give you an update on its development status. So again, thanks a lot for joining us today, and thank you, Serge, for being willing to give us your overview and your deep knowledge. It's a pleasure to have you with us today, and I'm very much looking forward to learning more about your perspectives on myelofibrosis. So with that, I'll hand it over to you.
Hello, everybody. Let's move to the next slide. That's the slide. Hans and colleagues at Galecto, thank you so much for having me join your efforts in developing a new therapies for myelofibrosis. I'm very enthusiastic and I'm looking forward to partnership with you to tackle the problem in myelofibrosis that is such a big problem, and it's reflected in its name of the disease itself. Fibrosis of the bone marrow is the culprit that requires effective therapies to eliminate it, to prevent it, and improves the activities and life and longevity of life of patients with myelofibrosis. So thank you so much for having me as a part of the team. Let's go to the next slide, please. When we talk about myelofibrosis, and today we're going to be talking about the fibrotic myelofibrosis or overt myelofibrosis. For clarification purposes, it's important to say that WHO classification of hematological neoplasms in 2016 did introduce a prefibrotic or early primary myelofibrosis without any fibers. That's a rather benign disease, and it's described on this slide on the left side. This is disease that we manage as patients with ET, with high platelets, with very good outcome. What we are focused is on deadly part of myelofibrosis, the one that we always talk about, the one that comes with progressive constitutional symptoms, progressive organomegaly, enlargement of the spleen and symptoms, and progressive worsening of the bone marrow through fibrosis. And this is described in more detail on the right side of the slide. This progressiveness of the disease decreases the quality of life of the patients, decreases performance status, incapacitation, immobility sets in, multi-organ failure. Patients die within 5 to 7 years from myelofibrosis-related complications. About a quarter of the patients does progress to acute myeloid leukemia, and that transformation plus complications related to myelofibrosis itself leads to premature death within about 5 to 7 years. That is the focus, the most aggressive of MPNs, the deadliest of all that we need to tackle together to resolve those issues. Next slide, please. Now, all the MPNs or myeloproliferative neoplasms by general descriptions are kind of a chronic diseases. Myelofibrosis, indeed, it's not so chronic at all. Look at this table, which described a comparison of the clinically relevant problems that patients with myelofibrosis face at the time of diagnosis, a middle column in this table, and at the 1 year after living with the disease. Only 1 year after living with the disease. So if you just look at, for example, the first two lines in this table, hemoglobin less than 10, that's the clinically relevant anemia, is already present in up to 40% of the patients at the diagnosis. And after 1 year of living with the disease, two-thirds of the patients are anemic. Platelet count below 100, significant, even prognostically significant and clinically relevant problem, is seen in about a third of the patients after living with the disease for 1 year. So progressive nature is one of the major characteristics of myelofibrosis. That's why the life expectancy is really actually short. It's not a chronic in the sense that you live forever with that disease. It is really short, 5 to 7 years. Next slide, please. So how do we tackle this problem, this semi-aggressive disease, if you like to call it? We go by the guidelines, and this is the simplified version of our United States NCCN guidelines that are readily available and updated every year. And we start with prognostication. This is on the left side of the slide. We are prognosticating to see who has, among the patients with myelofibrosis, life expectancy less than 5 years, because then we can justify sending patients to a bone marrow transplant. The bone marrow transplant has its own problems, high mortality rate, and therefore it's not for everybody. We classify patients by using different prognostic scoring systems in what you see on the left side, lower risk patients. Typically, these are low or intermediate one risk patients by different prognostic scoring systems, or higher risk patients, which are typically intermediate two or high risk patients, again, by different prognostic scoring systems that are listed at the bottom of the slides. So that's a first fork, transplant or no transplant. But unfortunately, I can tell you, and it's widely known, that the transplant is option for less than 10% of the patients, less than 10%. So we move on from the prognostication for the transplant to what we actually do. The next fork is a symptomatic disease, as you see on the right side in upper panel, symptomatic or not symptomatic. And here we have a good reason to employ JAK inhibitors, ruxolitinib is tested, or to control the high blood cell count in earlier lower-risk patients with interferon or hydria. But when we come to the high-risk patients, then those medications do not really work, and we are left with ruxolitinib or fedratinib with their benefit on the spleen and symptoms, as we know. And no medication is actually listed at all as a therapy for anemia, although it's one of the major problems, as we described. The major three problems are bad quality of life, symptomatic splenomegaly, and cytopenias, particularly anemia. Next slide, please. So what do we do? We do prognostication. We look at the guidelines. The guidelines are relatively general. You have a JAK inhibitors approved, ruxolitinib, fedratinib, but when you sit with the patient in a clinic, you see a number of different problems that you need to tackle. And here is the list of clinical needs on the left side. From anemia, a major problem, as you now know, from anemia to symptomatic splenomegaly and other types of problems that we can face. For, and this is in red color, for symptomatic splenomegaly or constitutional symptoms, we readily employ ruxolitinib or fedratinib. And I will explain the utility and benefit of these two drugs. Ruxolitinib may improve the life of the patients and may prolong it for a couple of years. That's why it's listed under improved survival. But any other therapy that is listed here is not approved, and it's not approved because it works rarely in a smaller proportion of the patients, if it works at all. And if it works, then it works for a short period of time. Next slide, please. So what does the ruxolitinib do? We all know that it decreases the spleen, and this is a waterfall. Every vertical line is the one patient, and going from zero down in this graph is improvement in the spleen. So we can easily see in an orange color, these are treated patients with ruxolitinib, that ruxolitinib will, in great majority of the patients, help patients with the spleen, but to different extent. There is hardly anybody who is a primary refractory, maybe few percentage points, but there is a variety of the benefits. You see from few percentage points to a lot. The response is usually defined as a 35% decrease in the volume by MRI or half by palpation. So that's the primary benefit of ruxolitinib on the organs, and that's the spleen. What we have in the blue color is best available therapy, which is in this case hydroxyurea most of the time. So I get the questions about hydroxyurea. It doesn't really work. You can see here. That's why for control of the spleen, we utilize JAK inhibitors, and ruxolitinib is the one. Next slide. And the quality of life improves. We know that the JAK inhibitors have this anti-proliferative effect. That's why we have the improvement in the spleen. And they have anti-inflammatory effect, and that is improvement in the quality of life. You have here a spectrum of benefits comparing to best value therapy. No question, improves the quality of life and the spleen. Next. But at the same time, it's myelosuppressive. That is the limitation of the JAK inhibitors. Non-selectivity for JAK2 mutation. It works well by anti-proliferative and anti-inflammatory mechanisms, but at the same time, we have a problem with the low platelets. You see this on the left side. And the red blood cells, hemoglobin, it's lower in patients as well. We therefore actually dose the ruxolitinib based on the platelet number. And for anemia, we have to transfuse. We add another agent, perhaps in every practice, to counteract the anemia. That's the main problem in management with JAK inhibitors. Next. So how do we do that? That's really intersection of the science and the art. This is official British guideline for management of patients with JAK inhibitors, where you have benefits at the top of the slide, spleen and symptoms, and hematological toxicity. And you have to balance between the benefit and risk. And none of this can be really described with precision. That's why we don't have a definitions of suboptimal response or a definition of a loss of response. It's really a balance in management of these patients, which relies on the judgment of the involved physician. Next. And the therapy lasts on average about 3 years. These are the compilation of the durability of the therapy with ruxolitinib over time through multiple different trials. And most of them are in the middle. You can see by 3 years, we lose half of the patients. So median duration is 3 years, except, and this is in red color, you can see obviously on the left side, patients with the low platelet counts, they don't do well. This is one of the major problems here. And during the management, even if the average duration is 3 years, the problems with anemia and thrombocytopenia are exacerbated and affect the management of the therapy with ruxolitinib. Next. And therefore, what's the main reason for stopping ruxolitinib? And it's anemia. And then there is some thrombocytopenia here as well. But again, for thrombocytopenia, we learn how to adjust the dose. There are guidance what to do. For anemia, there are no guidance, and anemia is the major problem. See, anemia is the leading cause for ruxolitinib discontinuations. In fact, at the end of therapy with ruxolitinib, these patients still have a smaller spleen, but they have much more of anemia and thrombocytopenia. Myelosuppression is a problem. Bone marrow failure is the problem. The fibrosis is the problem. The fibrosis does not generally goes away with ruxolitinib in any time frame that is reasonable, and it does worsen over time and leads to a failure of JAK inhibitors. Next. After ruxolitinib, the life is short. There is not much one can do. It is specifically shorter in patients with the low platelets. The low platelets at the beginning of ruxolitinib and after ruxolitinib are identified as one of the major bad prognostic factors for these patients, as are some genetic mutations. But low blood cell count is the problem, as now you have a good sense throughout the life of the patients with myelofibrosis. Next. And then we had the development of fedratinib. It was approved in the United States 2 years ago. And the dose that was approved is listed on the left side. That's the Jakarta 3, the phase 3 Jakarta trial that compared fedratinib to placebo. And in that setting, fedratinib 400 milligrams a day, which is on the left side, led to approval in the spleen and symptoms in a ballpark similar to what the official response is for ruxolitinib. These days, we utilize fedratinib much more in the second-line setting in those patients that are failing from a perspective of not controlling the spleen and still have a good bone marrow reserve. This is on the right side, 30% response rate in a second-line setting for the spleen and 27% for the symptoms. Next slide. What we face with fedratinib is some challenges in management of the patients. We utilize 400 milligrams a day, but we have to give patients more pills. Unfortunately, two-thirds of the patients have a degree of diarrhea, vomiting, and nausea, the box at the top of this table. This is through perhaps inhibition of FLT3 that fedratinib does and requires education of the patients, giving prophylactic antidiarrheals, prophylactic anti-nausea medications, and that increases basically complexity of delivery of a care. Anemia and thrombocytopenia are seen to the same degree as it is with ruxolitinib in the lower part of the table. And finally, we have on the right side a black box warning for use of fedratinib where we need to measure thiamine and supplement thiamine, which I do, because of potential of inhibition of thiamine uptake from GI tract by fedratinib and causing Wernicke encephalopathy, very rare condition, but it's serious central nervous system toxicity. Next slide. And so we are left with two JAK inhibitors without anything else that is effective on the cytopenias and the bone marrow fibrosis, really. So what do we do with anemia? No drug listed. What we do is start the testing of erythropoietin level. And if it's low, less than 500, we may give it erythropoietin-stimulating agents. Otherwise, we go to danazol, which is the anabolic steroid, or immunomodulatory inhibitory drugs like thalidomide or lenalidomide. All off-label use because, again, hardly anybody responds, very small percent response rate, and if there is response, it doesn't last long. Next. Now, what do we do about the thrombocytopenia? We said thrombocytopenia is a big problem. Well, the purpose of the blank slide is to highlight the need for therapies to improve the platelets. I don't have therapy that would be improving the platelets. We struggle, as I described, with the anemia. We struggle a lot with thrombocytopenia. We don't have any medications with a track record of improving platelets. Let's go to the next slide. And therefore, many say, at the end, what else can we do other than medications? Maybe we can remove the spleen. One indication for splenectomy, which is hardly ever done anymore, is the significant refractory anemia or thrombocytopenia, which prevents you from providing any other therapy at all, but it's associated with a significant morbidity, 10% mortality in general. And then liver becomes big after that, and life expectancy is about a year and a half in general after splenectomy. So that's not really something that I endorse very well. Next. And that's why you have many studies, right? There are many studies that are combinations with the JAK inhibitors to address the issue of accelerated blastic phase when people go to acute myeloid leukemia, cytopenias as the goal of therapy. You see here listed the luspatercept, danazol, thalidomide, pomalidomide. The only novelty here at the moment is luspatercept. Everything else is old-fashioned drugs. And the many drugs that are being combined with the JAK inhibitors to boost the response in spleen and symptoms. And unfortunately, most of them are myelosuppressive. Next slide. And we have a number of other novel targets that are being explored in a second-line setting. You see a partial list of many phase 1, 2, and even phase 3 studies in a second-line setting after JAK inhibitors targeting novel markers of possibly disease abnormality-related targets that you can then improve and perhaps help to the patients. Next slide. And this is where we enter a LOX-L2, right? This is where now we have a good sense what is the problem. Fibrosis is there. No medications that tackles that issue. No medications that are effective for improving the function of the bone marrow, improving the anemia, thrombocytopenia, that would help majority of the patients, help patients that are on JAK inhibitors. We enter here the LOX-L2 target as the enzyme that is, as you can see on this cartoon, involved with the fibril collagen elastins in extracellular matrix of the bone marrow. This is a very nice cartoon that depicts where do we find it. Throughout the bone marrow, basically, it's expressed uniformly, and you can, with proper staining, it is on the left side, easily objectivize that target and understand what is happening. The cartoon on the right side is just trying to explain the interaction between different cellular compartments in the bone marrow and the role for LOX-L2 in that setting. Next. And there are, of course, a number of different genes, the LOX genes in the family members. And what I'm showing here on the left side is the LOX family gene expression in the myelofibrosis to answer the question, why LOX-L2? Why this one? Why not all the other ones? And the reason is clear here. We have the highest expression of the LOX-L2. And therefore, as you see in the cartoon on the right side, that connection makes sense, right? We have fibrosis there, myelofibrosis from the stromal cells, from the malignant cells are interacting. The LOX-L2 is highly expressed, and that leads in a large part to high fibrosis content of the bone marrow. Next. And therefore, we are entering now the GB2064 as the medication for myelofibrosis. And again, I'm really enthusiastic about implementation of this new strategy in our clinical studies to see whether we can really do, it makes a lot of sense, to counteract the fibrosis and improve the bone marrow function as the primary goal, and then help the patients in all other aspects as well throughout their life. So this is the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, as you can see in the first bullet, that has characteristics that are much better than the prior therapies that target the same target, which was the antibody. It's called simtuzumab antibody that was tried earlier on without success. The GB2064 is much different. It has a long duration effect in the bone marrow that would be independent of the plasma concentration with low systemic toxicity due to low systemic drug levels for most of the time. And therefore, this is different novel approach in targeting fibrosis in the bone marrow. What we expect with the therapy is in the lower part of the slide, reducing fibrosis, having anti-cancer effect, that means basically improvement of the bone marrow function, we improve in the quality of life with that, and perhaps some effect on the spleen. And obviously, that would be even a very nice combination partner with other already available therapies. Next slide. The characteristics of the GB2064 were studied very well in the preclinical models. And as Hans said, we are about to embark on a phase 2 study in the patients with myelofibrosis. But characteristics of the therapy so far in preclinical models are listed here. And the point made here in the graph itself is the most important one because the maximum enzyme inhibition with the GB2064 is much better than previous attempts to target this LOXL2 target with simtuzumab. So we should take away the history and have a new start with a much better therapy, which would be much more potent in the bone marrow and help our the patients with these clinically relevant endpoints. Next. So the summary slide is very easy to understand. I hope we have a high expression of LOXL2. We have a very active drug in a GB26 in preclinical models, and we are very happy to engage in enrolling patients in the phase 2 open label study. And that's the next slide to describe what is happening. This is called MyLOX1 study. This is really a pilot study in patients that are ineligible for JAK inhibitors through having a low blood cell count. I explained this well. These are patients that are not served well at all, or patients that were previously treated with JAK inhibitors and now have a low blood cell count and are not in therapy anymore. 16 patients will be included, and we will provide the therapy for a prolonged duration of time, over 9 months, because it may take longer time for fibrosis to be effectively affected, so that we see a clinically relevant endpoints and the change in the bone marrow fibrosis that is one of the major goals of the trial. So clinically relevant endpoints, correlative studies with understanding of the activity of the drug, all packaged together in this really exciting small study for us all to do. The testing that is done, that is listed on the right side in a table, throughout the study is crucial for us to, at the end, hopefully quickly, because 60 patients should not take too much time, to understand fully clinical benefits of GB2064. Next one. So this is a summary slide. So I hope that we all agree together that this is a really exciting new project, looking at the target that is readily expressed and makes sense to target with the drug that has a good rationale and the good preclinical models. The study also embarks on its myelofibrosis path based on a phase 1 study that was done, that is described in the lower part of the slides, in healthy volunteers. And in important to say, chronic toxicology studies were already completed as well. So we are expecting to quickly accrue these 6 patients as soon as study is open, and have for you in a very near future the results in these 16 patients. So thank you so much.
Hans, you're on mute.
So thanks a lot, Serge. This was really an excellent overview over myelofibrosis and the clear unmet medical need here. I think it's very inspiring to see how you're taking this on, urging us to also look at thrombocytopenia as something that we should be focusing on helping for these patients. Thanks again. This was really good. I'm now going to tell you a little bit more about GB2064 and why we are so excited about that. So if you could go to the next slide. As Serge said, GB2064 is a small molecule inhibitor of the enzyme LOXL2. It works by binding in the catalytic site and preventing the enzyme from acting. And what the enzyme does is that it cross-links the collagen fibrils that form the backbone of fibrosis. So by inhibiting LOXL2, you get individual collagen fibrils that can be broken down, in contrast to the mesh, which cannot be broken down. Myelofibrosis is an orphan indication with between 16,000 and 18,000 patients in the US. Church has already talked about the JAK inhibitors, but you should note that even though it's an orphan indication, it's a very large market opportunity with sales of nearly $2 billion for Jakafi, the market leader. And again, I just wanted to reiterate that LOXL2 is markedly upregulated in the bone marrow of patients with myelofibrosis, in contrast to other members of the LOX enzyme family. And that's why it's rational to be targeting and to work with a very specific inhibitor of LOXL2 as we're doing. On the next slide, please. Again, I want to reiterate what Serge said about the difference between GB2064 and previous attempts at targeting LOXL2. Gilead was developing an antibody called simtuzumab, and they were developing as if it was an inhibitor of LOXL2, but actually it only inhibited 40% of the activity of the enzyme. And anybody who works with enzyme knows that in order to really impact the function of an enzyme, you need to inhibit it completely. And that's what we do with GB2064. Furthermore, GB2064 is a small molecule, so it can enter into the fibrotic tissue and penetrate to where the enzyme is sitting locked onto the collagen fibrils. This is not possible with an antibody. So in summary, we believe we have a much better way of targeting LOXL2, and we want to demonstrate that this works. We've already shown it preclinically, now we want to show it clinically. So the next slide. So we are very excited and to expect to imminently be able to announce that that we've started MYLOX-1, which is our phase 2A trial in myelofibrosis. Serge has already talked about the design. Just to reiterate that we have 16 evaluable patients planned for the trial, and we'll be treating them for 9 months. And we'll be looking at, does the drug work by reducing the fibrosis? Does that lead to improved blood formation? We'll be looking for the ability of us delivering the compound to the fibrotic tissue in the bone marrow. And we'll also be looking at the traditional markers of efficacy in the spleen and liver volume that JAK inhibitors are approved for. Next slide. So just in summary, there's lots of evidence for LOXL2 playing a central role in fibrosis. We have in GB2064 a uniquely active, selective, and potent inhibitor of the enzyme. In the phase 2A trial, we expect to be able to show that this compound reduces the fibrosis in the bone marrow, that leads to improvement, clinical improvement for the patients. This will have dramatic implications for the potential future treatment of myelofibrosis patients, but certainly also sets the stage for using this compound in other fibrotic diseases. So as Serge said, we are ready to start the clinical trial, and I look very much forward to be able to go back and inform that the study is underway. Next slide. So now this concludes our presentation section for this meeting. And it's now time to open up for questions. So with me, Serge is going to be available to answer, as well as our Chief Medical Officer, Bertil Lindmark, and our Chief Financial Officer, John Fried. So questions from anybody?
Thank you, Hans. So at this time, we'll begin conducting our question and answer session. As a reminder to the audience, you may submit your questions through the Q&A text box at the bottom of the webcast player. And to the analysts, we now invite you to join via Zoom. So please hold for a moment while we poll for questions, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
Thank you for waiting. So the first question comes from Sebastian Vanderschoot from Kempen. Sebastian, you may go ahead and unmute your line.
Hi guys, good morning and good afternoon. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Great.
Hi Sebastian. So,
hi, I have a couple. Thank you for the very nice presentation, Dr. V. The first one was, if I understand correctly, the mechanism of action between GB2064 and the JAK2 inhibitors are different, then do you also expect that there will be differences in the clinical readout? So, for example, do you expect that spleen size will be reduced in the same magnitude, or can that differ? And can you also maybe explain what the effects of JAK inhibitors are on a cellular level compared to the LOXL?
Yeah, thank you very much for excellent questions. The mechanism actions are different. We have anti-proliferative and anti-inflammatory potential of JAK inhibitors very well established as the fact. We know that cytokines go down. We know that the spleen is decreasing through anti-proliferative effects. And that has an effect on the bone marrow to a limited degree. We know that the bone marrow fibrosis may go to lower grade of fibrosis in a quarter of the patients after 4 years of therapy with ruxolitinib. The median duration of the therapy with ruxolitinib is 3 years in clinical studies, and it appears to be even shorter in the community setting. So there is no clinically relevant effect on the bone marrow, and the clinically relevant effect on the bone marrow that would be seen in improvement of the red blood cell count and improvement of the platelets does not happen. It's quite opposite, as we said, through this anti-proliferative effect, you have a significant decrease of the red blood cells and platelets, and that is clinically so important and affects the utility of the JAK inhibitors and the durability of it. So having a completely different mode of action that would tackle the underlying problem in fibers in the bone marrow, which we all agree are part of the progressive nature of the worsening of the clinically relevant points, progressive nature of having more anemia, transfusion dependency, more of the thrombocytopenia, that is completely different. And in future, would perhaps even call, as I may have suggested already, for these options, if therapeutic options are available, to combine them. I mean, I can clearly see that the improvement in the bone marrow fibrosis would lead to improvements in the anemia and thrombocytopenia, much less probably on the spleen, quite a lot on the symptoms, and the combinations in the future between the JAK inhibitors and antifibrotic medications like GB2064 are just, a logical next step.
Very clear. Thank you very much. And then you also briefly touched upon that LOXL2 is increased in myelofibrosis, but I also saw that some other LOXL enzymes were also increased. Does it make sense to use a pan LOXL inhibitor, and or do you see any drawbacks with using a molecule that would inhibit all these LOXL enzymes?
That's a good question, and I think Hans volunteers to answer that question.
Thank you, Serge. Yes, I'd be happy to. Yes, so the certainly the enzyme that is most markedly upregulated in myelofibrosis patients is a LOXL2. There may be some modest upregulation of LOX as well, but LOXL2 is the key culprit. LOX enzymes play important roles in the overall homeostasis of the connected tissue in the body and maintaining elastin and collagen. So using a pan inhibitor is inherently less specific and therefore more likely to have undesired effect than specifically targeting the enzyme, namely LOXL2, that's upregulated in the patients. So for us, it makes a lot more sense to go with a specific rather than a pan inhibitor.
Very clear, gotcha. And then for my final question, then using the LOXL2 inhibitor. What are the type of react, like to what magnitude of effects you are looking at for the clinical readout next year? So what are the biomarkers you're really looking at, and what is the magnitude of effect that we can expect?
Well, I think that's very hard to do, right? This is the first study that we are doing, and we're doing it exactly to figure out what are the most relevant endpoints for this specific therapy. So I think it's way too early to set sort of percentage reduction in bone marrow fibrosis or something like that. We'll be looking for clinically meaningful effects in this trial. I don't know, Serge, if you want to.
Yeah. So the clinically meaningful endpoints are what will drive a future development. We certainly would like to see the connection between the improvement in the bone marrow fibrosis. And remember, the study is about 9 months on purpose, because it may take time for the fibrosis to really be affected properly. With that, you would expect the clinically relevant improvement in the platelets and the red blood cells, and improvements in the quality of life. These are the typical endpoints that matter the most, and we don't have medications for those endpoints to our disposal in every practice, so particularly for the platelets. And so these are, in my mind, what I would be looking from the clinical perspective, easy to understand endpoints after 9 months of therapy, and see whether we have that through this new mechanism of action, that benefit that would cover basically all the patients, because they all come at one point in time in their life with the low red blood cells and low platelets.
And in addition, we're measuring a whole host of collagen breakdown and build up biomarkers to help illustrate the mechanism of action.
Thank you for the question, Sebastian. So the next question comes from Thomas Smith at Leerink. Thomas, you may go ahead and ask your question.
Hey guys, thanks for putting together the event and for taking the questions. I guess one for Dr. Bartosek, and thanks for the presentation and the insights. You talked about the potential for LOXL2 inhibition and I guess use in combination with other therapies that are in development. Just thinking through the mechanism, and I know you had a number of compounds listed on a couple different slides there. Just help us kind of better tease out in your mind, what are the most promising combination partners mechanistically that you're thinking through?
As you saw on the slide, there is a separation of the patient population based on a need and based on a line of therapy. We are all aware of those two JAK inhibitors, where we talked about using the ruxolitinib most of the time in frontline setting for spleen and symptoms, and the fedratinib in those patients that have a spleen and symptoms but do not have anemia and thrombocytopenia in the second line setting. That's the scope of work that we can do at the moment. And therefore, you would say, what can I do better in the frontline setting? Can I add another agent to improve the spleen and symptoms? Yes. So you saw a list. There are a lot of those medications that are adding active agents for the spleen and symptoms to ruxolitinib. But at the same time, as you very well know, they're all myelosuppressive. Navitoclax, PI3 kinase inhibitor, BET inhibitors, they have their share of lowering the platelets, for example. So I'm not sure how we're going to see much of the benefit because of the management issues with the myelosuppression. But that's one subgroup of patients. The other is adding medications that will tackle the anemia. They may be also tested alone. And here we have luspatercept, right? Luspatercept in a phase 3 randomized study, independent study, adding it to ruxolitinib for people that are transfusion requiring. So tackling one problem, anemia, adding different benefit to JAK inhibition. So you cover three problems, right? Spleen and symptoms with JAK inhibitor, anemia there. No drug here that would improve the platelets. And then you go to the second line. You have fedratinib there, as I explained. What about the others? You have momelotinib in development for anemia and the symptoms in second line. You also have pacritinib for patients with low platelets, and a bunch of other drugs that are trying to see what they're going to be doing, actually. A lot of exploration there. So having an antifibrotic medication with a clear mode of action that will improve the function of the bone marrow, both on the aspects of anemia and thrombocytopenia would leap over any of the other drugs that are being developed for anemia only, and would be obviously valuable for patients with low blood cell count that suffer from those on its own, and a valuable in the future combination partner for majority of the people who are treated with JAK inhibitors because they suffer from anemia and thrombocytopenia. So that's the clinical benefit that leaps over other anti-cytopenia medications because of possibility of tackling the problem in the bone marrow that will lead to improvement in all aspects of cytopenias, not only one.
Okay, great. Thanks. Yeah, that's appreciate the comments and the insights. And then maybe a question for Hans and the team. Can you guys just talk about the dosing for 2064? I think in the MAD portion of the phase one study, you went up to 2 grams per day. Can you just talk about how you landed on the 1 gram per day dose in the proof of concept study?
Yeah, I think we dosed up to the practical dose limit. So there weren't any limiting dose toxicities. And also in animal experiments, we didn't see any dose limiting dose. So it's more a practical, how many capsules per day and how many tablets per day can we allow the patients to take. The 1 gram dose is well defined, defendable from a PK point of view, and obviously what we don't know is the drug levels in the bone marrow. So we want to use the highest dose that we tested in healthy volunteers, and that is practical to be taken per day. And then we're going to check for the dose levels in the bone marrow and all the clinical effects and also the fibrosis effects on the biomarkers. So all in all, we hope that this will be a good test of the mechanism. And obviously, given the fact that we are much more effective in inhibiting the LOXL2 enzyme with 100% pseudo irreversible inhibition, you know, we hit the enzymatic center and GB2064 sits there for a long period of time inhibiting the enzyme. We hope that that's going to result in clinical efficacy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Thanks for the color. And then just a last question. Can you just remind us on that formulation, Bertel? It sounds like delivered via capsule. Like, how many capsules per day are we talking to get to the 1 gram dose?
And Hans, do you recall how many capsules? I think it's like 8 capsules. Yes. Twice daily.
It is.
Okay. Okay. And plans for formulation refinement going forward?
Sure.
Of course.
Okay. Okay. Thanks, guys. Yeah, I appreciate you taking the questions, and thanks again for putting together the event.
Thanks for the questions, Thomas. I'll now turn the call back over to John Freeve for any questions that may have come in over the webcast.
Great. Thanks. And we do have a few, so I'll try to get through these quickly and streamline them a bit. Serge, a couple of questions from Alex Stranahan at Bank of America. First, would you use another antifibrotic after Rux if it also had an adverse effect on platelets?
After ruxolitinib, patients may have more anemia and more thrombocytopenia, as it's very well now described in a number of reports. To use antifibrotic in those patients to improve the blood cell count makes a lot of sense. The mechanism of action is different than through JAK inhibitors. And if you can improve the bone marrow function with antifibrotic, you can then revisit the idea of rechallenging patient with the JAK2 inhibitor. There are papers that are talking about rechallenging patients with ruxolitinib after ruxolitinib. And as we said during the presentations, fedratinib is the choice in the second setting, but it's limited by its own myelosuppressive effects. So if we could improve the bone marrow function by decreasing the fibrosis and improving the red blood cells and platelets, that would give a more chance for reinstating another JAK inhibitor in a second line setting.
Great. Thanks, Serge. And a follow-up from Alec on that is, what study size do you think might be necessary for registration in myelofibrosis? Any color?
Not for me. Maybe Bertil or Hans would know.
No, I don't think I think that's really depending on the effect size we see in the MYELOX-1 trial. Obviously, if we see dramatic effects, then I think the urge to actually get a therapy on the market sort of reduces the variability and reduces the need for large studies. But let's get back to that when we see good results in the MYELOX-1.
Great. And a question from Tiago Fouth at Credit Suisse. Hans Bertel, could you guys highlight and discuss any key secondary endpoints or biomarkers that the phase 2A study will measure that could attest to early signs of efficacy in myelofibrosis, given the relatively small sample size that we're looking at?
Well, as I said, we're looking at both the spleen size and the combined hepatosplenic size. Additionally, we're looking at effects in the bone marrow with centrally read bone marrow fibrosis measures, and also the whole host, as I mentioned, of collagen biomarkers and collagen breakdown biomarkers. And in addition, we're looking at drug levels in plasma and drug levels in the bone marrow to understand sort of if we reach exactly the right compartment. As we all know, bone marrow is a very specialized tissue, and you need to make sure you get there and you get to the right concentrations. So lots of interesting data in the trial that we're measuring, and that together with the clinical data, I hope is going to be good to illustrate the effect of LOXL2 inhibition.
Great, Serge. Next question comes from Jay Olson at OPCO. It's a multi-part question. One, what is the greatest unmet need for myelofibrosis? Two, based on the disease modifying biomarkers that you're aware of, how can they be incorporated into clinical trials moving forward? Three, does Jakafi have any disease modifying properties? And four, which drugs currently in clinical development that you're aware of are most promising for disease modification? And I can go through those again if you need me to.
Okay. All right, number one. So
unmet need, yes.
Yeah. So the unmet need can be looked at in two ways. The most aggressive and deadliest population of the patients where we need something to save their life and improve the function of the bone marrow and decrease the spleen and quality of life is the second line setting after JAK inhibitors. 70% of the patients appear to be going from the first line JAK inhibitors to a second line, whatever that might be. And the life is short, platelets are low. I said before, the anemia is a problem. That's the area of unmet need in terms of the patient needs. But in terms of the covering the number of patients with the new medications, the area of anemia and thrombocytopenia, cytopenia, is the largest area of unmet need, because from the first line to the second line, and even in the 10 to 15% of patients that don't have a big spleen, you have anemia and thrombocytopenia. So in terms of the covering patients that are in a need of something, that's the area of unmet need, the largest one, the anemia and thrombocytopenia. The next question?
Second was, what are the disease modifying biomarkers that could be most easily incorporated into clinical trials?
Typically, people usually talk about decreasing the bone marrow fibrosis, decreasing the cytokine levels, and decreasing the allele burden of the JAK2 mutation or other mutations. But here we have a different mode of action. So there was already a question or two before, what other markers are there to follow? And that is exploratory part of the ongoing study, which will lead us to answer that question with much more precision.
Next part of that was, does Jakafi have any disease modifying properties?
Okay. The best answer to that is to say, if the patients live longer with the therapy, then there must be some form of the disease modification. So ruxolitinib or Jakafi decreases the cytokines, for example, and the decrease in cytokines was very well described as a connection to decreasing the symptoms. The bone marrow fibrosis doesn't really go away much at all, as I explained before. The allele burden of the JAK2 mutation, for example, goes down about 20%, not much of a change, but people do live longer. So perhaps there are other factors here that we are not aware of, are about to discover, perhaps through MYELOX-1 study, that would answer the questions, what are the real parameters of a disease modification? Because we are limited in knowledge here.
And Serge, the last part of that was what drugs currently in clinical development that you're aware of are most promising for disease modification?
Well, disease modifications is such a problematic issue, right? Many drugs are clinically active to some degree, and many of them would obviously, that makes sense to me, if there is a clinical activity, have some kind of a biological effect. Either there will be some change in fibers or change in the cytokines or change in the allele burden, the three typical ones that mentioned. There is no real connection between those biological parameters and the clinical endpoints in those studies. That's the main problem here, to answer the questions, which drugs are really disease modifying. They're doing something to the biology, but disease modifications is difficult to define, and then to say, oh, yes, this drug does it, and or this does doesn't.
And Serge, last question from Jay at OPCO. Could GB2064, in your opinion, increase the population of patients eligible for HSCT, and what are the gating factors for myelofibrosis patients to receive HCST?
This is hematopoietic stem cell transplant, probably. We're mm-hmm. talking about the transplant. Okay. The transplant is the first fork in the guidelines is to transplant, no transplant, right? But less than 10% of patients go to the transplant. What we are trying to do, first of all, is to increase the numbers by giving them the JAK inhibitors, improve the performance status, metabolism, weight, and that to some degree, not to great degree, works. Some patients become transplant eligible. If you can optimize the delivery of the JAK inhibitors with the drug that would be combined with it to improve the anemia and thrombocytopenia, then you can optimally treat the patients with the JAK inhibitors themselves. And many more patients will become transplant candidates, therefore. Because the limitations of the JAK inhibitors, as we said, is anemia and thrombocytopenia. So you counteract that with a partner, for example, like GB2064. You optimize the therapy and delivery of the JAK inhibitors, many more patients will become transplant candidates throughout their life.
Great. Thanks, Serge. Next question from an anonymous person is, what are your views regarding reducing elevated hepcidin to treat anemia in myelofibrosis patients?
One of the interesting possible mechanism of action for momelotinib that was published in September last year as a correlative to improvement in the anemia parameters in open label phase 2 study, which is being explored as a target by other involved sponsors in the MPN field. There are other specific drugs, so-called ALK2 inhibitors, for example, or hemojuvelin antibody, that are trying to target to more precision and perhaps then more efficacy the hepcidin pathway or iron metabolism issue, with the possibility of improving the anemia. The targeting of the fibrosis, on the other hand, is not limited to, in my view at least, improvement in just one of the cell lines, right? If you would be decreasing the fibrosis grade, my expectations are that the function of the bone marrow will improve in all aspects. That means more of red blood cells, more of platelets, and if the white cells is low, more of the white cells.
Great. And I'll turn it now to the last question. It's, again, a multi-part one, but only two parts this time. Serge, to your knowledge, given the trials that you've participated in, are there any other companies that are exploring LOXL2 as a target, other than obviously Gilead, which previously has explored this? And if so, to what end? And secondly, what are your thoughts on why Galecto's GB2064 could be differentiated in inhibiting this target?
Well, I was actually leading the Semtuzumab study, which was published a few years ago. And the cartoon that I used in my presentation is from that paper. A lot of good preclinical information to target the LOXL2, and that's why I'm really excited to pursue it with Galecto here. But there are other companies that perhaps Hans or Bertil know much more in detail what they do and what will be differentiating factor here, and they may join me in answering that particular aspect of that question.
So we are not aware of any other companies developing a specific LOXL2 inhibitor that's in the clinic. Pharmaxis in Australia is developing a pan-LOX inhibitor that they are pursuing for myelofibrosis. And as I already discussed, We believe that that's a different approach that is not as specific and could potentially lead to unwanted effects because you're inhibiting all of the LOX enzymes and not just the one that's upregulated in myelofibrosis.
Great. And that's all we've got on the inbound questions. So appreciate everyone's time and help here. Hans, turn it back to you.
Thank you. Thanks, Sean. Thanks to the audience for your interest and very insightful questions. It's been a pleasure to host this event, and I would again like to thank you, Serge, for such an insightful presentation and for sharing your extensive expertise in this field. We look forward to keeping you updated on developments at Galecto and having more events like this one informing you on the different programs that we're running. So thanks a lot. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you.